A famine is now imminent in the northern part of the Gaza Strip.
100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity.
As U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warns of a catastrophe in Gaza, Israel's allies are fretful. Yet Benjamin Netanyahu says no international pressure will stop Israel from achieving its war aims. That situation, as well as strains in NATO over the Ukraine crisis and uncertainty about who'll be calling the shots in the White House by the end of the year, is a testing prospect for European foreign ministers and for those vying for succession. Nowhere more so than in Britain's Labour Party, under closest scrutiny, as it looks likely to form the next UK government. But would a new foreign secretary in London encounter a Secretary Blinken or a Donald Trump appointee? Welcome to Power Play from Politico, where we talk to some of the world's most influential people on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm Anne McElvoy, and my guest this week has his eye on the job with the grandest address in Whitehall, King Charles Street, Labour's David Lammy. For someone with impeccable connections to senior Democrats in the US, he joined a dinner date with Barack Obama in London just this week. How would a centre-left government in the UK-US special relationship differ from a decade of conservative foreign policy? David Lammy, welcome to Power Play.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
If the polls are correct, you could well be Britain's next foreign secretary by the end of this year. That must be an exciting prospect, but it's hardly a stable, peaceful world that awaits you. What worries you most about the wars and crises around the world that you might inherit responsibility for in terms of Britain's global outlook?
Well, look, if I do become Foreign Secretary, I will be in my 25th year as a politician. And I am sort of reflecting on the world being so very, very different to the environment in which I arrived under Tony Blair. It was still the case in that era that Britain had a colony called Hong Kong. It was still the case that our economy was the size of China and India's combined. Today we're not in that place. And geopolitically, the environment feels rough and hugely challenging. So of course, I worry about war in Europe. And in relation to that, I worry about our partners in Europe and our relationship with our partners, which I think is essential going forward after a bitter, tough period post-Brexit. I worry too, of course, about the huge challenges in the Middle East. And I think that we are speaking at a time where regional escalation is not off the cards when one looks at the prospects of problems in Lebanon particularly, and of course, the prospects of further incursion into Rafah. So the world is more dangerous, more challenging geopolitically, and I'm weighing up that the UK has to be right at the centre of defending and supporting the values that we will share going forward.
Now, talking of that role, Foreign Secretary, it's currently held by David Cameron. Of course, we spoke to him on this podcast at Davos earlier in the year. He seemed to be enjoying the job, liberated by not carrying the burden of being PM. And it's even been suggested by some of his allies, namely George Osborne, that it'd be a good idea for Keir Starmer to keep on Mr. Cameron as Foreign Secretary. Oh, actually, Lord Cameron, I should say, as Foreign Secretary if Labour wins the election. That is a model that other countries sometimes continue. Now, presumably you think this is quite a bad idea.
Well, I have always got on with David Cameron, let me just say, on a personal level. And foreign policy in our system is an area where it's not partisan. There's a lot of areas where you would agree. But what I would say is this: I'm surprised that David Cameron has spent less time in European capitals and in Brussels, given war in Europe, the need for us all to work together to up our ability to arm our industrial capacity and military capacity, particularly. I reflect that we've seen very little engagement with China. James Cleverly did one visit. I'm not sure any other government minister has gone, notwithstanding the very clear eyes in which we have to have our relationship with China and the security issues that we have to keep uppermind. I am minded that from Antony Blinken to Janet Yellen, and of course, when you look across to Germany and France, the engagement is far more intense than you're seeing here. So look, yes, of course, on Israel-Gaza, I have seen engagement, but on a whole range of issues, this business of reconnecting Britain, never mind our reputation in the global south, has David Cameron really been able to address those issues? I'm not sure he has.
It doesn't sound like you think he should keep the job. There is an option B, some reported interest in diplomatic circles from Sue Gray, Chief of Staff to Keir Starmer, and others in widening the net of senior Labour appointments outside the present ranks, maybe bringing in people who are not even MPs at the moment. That would be something of a threat to the internal pecking order. I mean, are you absolutely sure you're slated for the next foreign secretary?
Oh, look, I've been around in politics too long to get preoccupied with the sort of boring Westminster
ups. Well, it's a matter of your next job.
Ups and downs. I've had the privilege of doing this, Rolf, in opposition for the last 2 years. The last person who had that privilege was William Hague. And in all seriousness, what it does mean is that you can get around the world and see it as it is. I've been to nearly every country in the Middle East over this last period. I spent time in Africa. I'll be there again towards the end of the week. A lot of time, of course, in Washington. It's really important that you're relational in this job. You're talking to other foreign secretaries across the globe. Those are the important issues. And I fully suspect that Keir Starmer, in terms of the Treasury, in terms of the Home Office, and in terms of foreign affairs, will probably keep those that have been in the role working hard on the development going forward. That it's up to him, but I suspect that that's what he will do.
Let's turn to the Middle East indeed, and the war in Gaza has ripped through domestic politics around Europe and across the West, of course, as well as what is happening on the ground. It has divided your own party, rebellions, resignations. The leadership shifting its position, I think, on the ceasefire as the war has gone on. Labour's position is now to support an immediate ceasefire, which for a long time was ruled out in conversation with me. I mean, we had earlier conversations about this, as did Keir Starmer, but acknowledging that Israel can't be expected to cease fighting if Hamas continues with its violence. Now, to some people, this is a bit of a muddled formulation. What do you really think about a ceasefire? And if you had the power to influence that even more, what would you do?
Well, look, a ceasefire requires two parties. Negotiations continue. It is my sincere hope, given that we're now in the early days of Ramadan, that we get that ceasefire and that it lasts. And that's what the Labour Party, of course, wants. I'm sure it's what the whole global community want to see. I also think in matters of life and death, it's important to focus on two things. One, the scale of loss in Gaza, the women and children who've lost their lives, should concern us all. And it cannot be right that as we speak, there are children starving to death almost in that country. It's also the case that many, many hostages have still not been returned. They need to be returned. It was our view back at the beginning of this crisis, towards the end of October, the only prospect of seeing that opening up was to get a pause. And we did see some hostages come out. And I think it's very likely that you won't see more hostages come out unless there is a ceasefire and the space in which to see them leave that situation and to see that horrific humanitarian situation alleviated. So that's why I'm really clear that we do need to see an immediate humanitarian ceasefire.
But if Israel mounts an offensive in Rafah, would you go further then and call for a permanent ceasefire, which is what many of your supporters want? And that slightly loses what I think the problem is with maybe what you've laid out, however eloquently, that is, it's, well, one thing and another, and you can't ask one side if you don't ask the other side. A lot of people are saying, actually, the situation is now so drastic on the ground. You point out those, the displacement, the starvation, the suffering, and the death of Palestinians, that in that case, wouldn't it be simpler to say Labour calls for a permanent ceasefire?
You can hold, at the one hand, the concerns, the very real concerns in Israel about their security, about the senior leadership of Hamas still being in place in Gaza, about, sadly, terrorists being there and the need to locate them and deal with that problem. You can hold that in the one hand and also say at the same time, when you've got a million people displaced, you've got Egypt being very clear about its own border, that the risk of a further offensive would cause a huge humanitarian catastrophe that I'm afraid is intolerable. So my view is with the mainstream of opinion across the global community. I sit with all colleagues, I think most colleagues in Europe and actually the United States current administration in saying that Rafah cannot go ahead and should not go ahead. At this stage, I haven't seen the plans that would give me comfort about those millions displaced. And actually, I'm not at all sure that it would assist with further hostages coming out. So at this stage, let's focus on the ceasefire. It allows the space for that to become permanent. And in the end, we all know that the future of this region will be negotiated. It is political. Let us get to that. And let us keep in mind the ideal of a two-state solution.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, most senior Jewish politician in the US, has said that Benjamin Netanyahu should step down and Israelis should go to the polls. Is that a position that you would identify with?
No. I think that in the end, I'm very minded that whilst there will be aspects, of course, of any country's domestic arrangements that I might not like, you deal with the government that you have, particularly when that is a democracy and it is the people that have elected it.
You've said the Labour government would consider unilaterally recognising a Palestinian state. You'd prefer to work with partners, including the US, in recognising statehood, but it depended how the ground lies. Now, that is a bit of a marshy, boggy statement. What do you mean by how the ground lies?
Well, Anne, one of the things that I think has struck many people observing this complex, most complex of crises is the, I think, surprise, frankly, and shock that many have sensed that quite a lot of the leadership in Israel and certainly Bibi Netanyahu are opposed to a two-state solution. Now, if you're opposed to a two-state solution, there are only two other alternatives. One is a one-state solution, in which you then have to explain how people can live side by side with full equality and without discrimination. And I'm not sure that's going to be possible in the context of the Israel-Gaza West Bank context that I go to and visit. Two, you're suggesting a no-state solution.
And no, the question I asked you was about unilateral recognition. It was not about the many benefits of a two-state solution, which has turned out to be elusive.
The position of the British Labour Party is that we do want to move to recognising a Palestinian state. We would like to do that with partners. And it's very interesting to see Western partners now beginning to say the same thing because they recognise that out of crisis, and you know, the Oslo Accords came out of huge crisis, the Intifada, we can see that progress again. And of course, I don't want to give the impression that recognition of Palestinian state is the answer. It is but a roadmap and a signal to a two states, which I hold dear.
Let's look at a subject that is adjacent to this, and this is anti-Semitism and the way that the Labour Party has handled it. Now, last week you offered Diane Abbott, your colleague, full support after reported comments by a Tory party donor who had used racial insults against her, and you said she was a trailblazer. She had faced more abuse than any other politician because she is a black woman. You were speaking there as a person of colour yourself, and that she had your full solidarity. But what does that mean? Because full solidarity, as far as Diane Abbott is concerned, means that she wants to go back to having a Labour whip, which has been denied to her because of her own comments and in a piece that she wrote and other comments which are deemed to be anti-Semitic by the leadership.
Well, look, there are two things going on there.
At least.
Let me just say, in representing the constituency of Tottenham in North London, I also represent in part the Stamford Hill area of London and have a very significant Haredi Orthodox Jewish community. I have always been very close to Britain's Jewish community. I stood with fellow Jews in the dark days of anti-Semitism in my own party outside Parliament saying enough is enough. And I was very quick to be critical of Diane Abbott in the statements that she made. She did apologise swiftly afterwards. It's important to put on the record. Last week, what came to light was gross racism. It was an attack on her. It was an attack on black women more broadly. It was almost amounted to an incitement to violence, which was extraordinary. And it came from a donor to the Conservative Party, and it was widely condemned. It took too long for our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, to condemn it, but he did condemn it, but he hasn't handed back the money. And in that sense, of course, I stand in solidarity with any parliamentarian. And I say that in the context in which we've had two parliamentarians murdered in the last few years, unimaginably, in our democracy. And it's in that context that I think right across the House has caused huge concern.
Certainly, but you saw Diane Abbott talk to your leader, Keir Starmer, on the floor of the Commons when her question was not called, and say that she would like the whip back. It was recorded as such, and she confirmed it. Should she have the whip back, which in terms of, for anyone listening outside the arcane world of British parliamentary politics, means being restored to full kind of voting rights as a Labour MP, which also, of course, means she could theoretically stand again as a Labour MP at the next election. If not, she can't. Now, your deputy party leader, Angela Rayner, says she would like to see Diane Abbott come back and have the whip restored to her. Do you agree?
Keir Starmer had to do a big job at cleaning up the Labour Party after one of the lowest moments, I think, frankly, in Labour history. And that was when our equality body found us in breach for committing anti-Semitism.
This was under the previous leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
Under the previous leader, Jeremy Corbyn, where I think things had gone awry. And as you know, I sat back and did not take a front bench position because I was hugely, hugely concerned. And I've been very supportive of Keir Starmer's attempts to sort this out, to clean up the mess and make the British Labour Party a home where everybody can come, and certainly where Jewish communities can feel safe. And I'm part of that tradition. I hark back to a period where frankly, black people like me and minorities, our Jewish brothers and sisters, we stand shoulder to shoulder. That's the tradition from which I come. So, look, it's not for me to determine who gets the whip and who doesn't get the whip and when someone's been suspended because they've breached the rules.
Listen to you. You know, come on, David Lammy, you are one of the most senior and experienced, as you've pointed out yourself, people in the front bench. You're very senior in shadow cabinet. You're a person of colour yourself. And as you say, you have taken a principled position when you think anti-Semitism, often driven by a sort of anti-Israel feeling, but that had tipped into anti-Semitism when the left wing were in charge of your party. You have many people saying that Diane Abbott should have the whip restored. You've got Keir Starmer saying there's a process. This has been going on a year. If you said to Keir Starmer, actually, I think it would be better to have Diane back fully, you would be listened to. What is your personal view?
Keir Starmer and I are both lawyers. There is a process. It's not a process in which politicians should meddle. That's what happened under Jeremy Corbyn. We now have a fair process. That process was run its course. And the outcome must be something that all of us can defend. I hope that that can be brought to a quick resolution soon, because I think this has gone on for a little longer than it should have done. But in all seriousness, I take anti-Semitism seriously.
So the process has gone on too long. In a sense, justice delayed is justice denied for Diane Abbott.
I'm a little bit concerned that the process has gone on quite as long as it has. I don't know the detail of why that is the case, but I do think that I hope...
Some people think it's so that she can't stand again at the next election.
I'm not sure it's got any. There's lots of different reports. I think there's also an aspect that's come up around anti-Semitism training and being committed to doing that, which I think is really important.
If she would agree to do that, she should come back.
I've done it. Why would anyone not do it?
We'll hear more from David Lammy, including on the US, UK politics, and how would he warm up relations with Europe after this. Let's move on and talk about transatlantic relations. This is, of course, a power play is a transatlantic study of people holding power or aspiring to do so. You've got close links to American politicians, particularly on the Democratic side. You dined with Barack Obama this week. Oh, how was that, by the way?
It's wonderful.
Let us sit at the table with you.
I've known President Obama now for two decades. He is erudite. His commitment, particularly to young people globally and leadership, I have huge respect for. And it was wonderful to see him in London again. And, you know, he's obviously still very much engaged. He met with Rishi Sunak. He met with Keir Starmer.
Did he give you any advice?
Well, he has already been speaking, obviously, to Keir Starmer. That's now pretty well documented.
But we want the bits that aren't pretty well documented. What do you talk about over a glass of wine, David? Come on.
Obama's approach is always seated in authenticity. We have seen Keir Starmer talking a lot more about the role that his mother struggled terribly with illness for many, many years. His father cared for her, talking about his backstory much more comfortably than perhaps we saw a few years ago. And I know that Obama had strong views that Keir should do that. And I think also President Obama has been really...
So the inspiration, can I just pause on that and say, what's the inspiration for those, actually, very much, as you say, more moving, sort of fuller accounts in a way that Keir Starmer has given of himself, based on that, the memoir of his father, that Barack Obama...
I think Barack Obama has been really clear on misinformation, disinformation, the challenge for politicians to communicate who they really are with a lot of noise. And he's one of the voices, he's not the only voice, but one of the voices that's encouraged that. And I think we've seen more of that in recent months.
I'm sure you'll tell me that any British government will work with anyone who's in the White House in the national interest and to keep that special relationship solid and develop it. Apparently, you've been in contact with Republicans. It's not impossible that it would be President Trump round two in the White House. Who are you talking to and what are they telling you?
Well, let me say, look, I mean, I've been one of the UK Parliament's Atlanticists all of my political life. I had the huge privilege of being the first Black Briton to study at Harvard Law School. I had the privilege of working in Silicon Valley as a lawyer when I first qualified. Of course, I've got lots of friendships in the Democrat Party, but also people like Condoleezza Rice. It's been wonderful to talk with people like Mike Pompeo. You know, most of the time, Mike Pompeo almost knows as much about Guyana, where my parents are from, as I do. He's a hero in Guyana. And recently, he's raised some big concerns about Venezuela and the amassing of troops on the Guyanese border. So we've had a lot to talk about with Robert O'Brien also. So, of course, it's important, given the relationship that the UK and the US has, it goes beyond who is in the White House or who is in number 10. It doesn't matter whether it's Blair and Bush or...
Is there anyone on the Trump or prospective Trump team that you think, yes, we need to engage here? You know, I find them impressive even if I disagree with their politics rather strongly.
I have to say, I read Hillbilly Elegy as soon as it came out a few years ago, and I just thought J.D. Vance was just a wonderful book. What spoke to me, I suppose? Well, he spoke about working class America. He spoke about left behind communities. He has a strong faith. These are themes in my own political story, Anne. And you're able to bridge those themes, even though, of course, myself and J.D. Vance are sitting on different sides.
Have you spoken to J.D. Vance?
Of course I spoke to J.D. Vance. I enjoyed very much speaking.
Now, that would be a podcast.
Him.
I think we need to get you both back.
Get him on the podcast if you hadn't already. I enjoyed spending time with him in Munich and look forward to spending a bit more time with him in the months ahead.
But you've described Donald Trump previously as a racist Ku Klux Klan and Nazi sympathiser, strong words, and that you would chain yourself to the door of number 10 in protest ahead of his state visit in 2017. Is there a money-back guarantee on that one, David?
Well, one, it's almost 7 years ago. And two, you will struggle, Anne, to find, and I'm sure if we looked at some of your columns, you will struggle.
I promise to do that.
You will struggle, I'm afraid, to find anybody in the British system, any parliamentarian that was around who did not express strong views about Donald Trump at any given point. I mean, I think that was the nature, frankly.
Come on, that was stronger than most. And do you think, just in fairness, you know, I think you were appalled and maybe a lot of people listening will think, hey, he was right first time around. Did you feel like, actually, when I look back on that, my words were too strong? Or and this actually plays on my mind a lot when I'm talking to people close to Donald Trump. Have we just got used to the Trump effect and perhaps we're a bit desensitized?
I think we might be a bit desensitized. But look, I think that the truth is in our system, as a backbencher, you can respond and say what you want. as a front bencher, and I've now been a front bencher for the last 4 or 5 years, there is a different responsibility. There's a collective responsibility to act in the national interests of this country. And therefore, of course, what you say is far more measured, far more thought through. And sometimes you have far more insight because you're in the room, you're in the conversations, you're in Washington in a way you weren't when you were a backbencher.
So I can imagine some context. Of your erstwhile fans listening to this and say, this was this fiery speaker I remember in the Commons saying things like that. He's sold out because he wants to be in the top ranks of government, and it kind of eats you up a bit because you become less authentic.
Read the speech I gave at that awful point at which Putin had invaded Ukraine, where I talked about what it means to be the descendant of enslaved people and look down the face of imperialism and seeing that again in Europe. I think that was pretty fiery. I think that was pretty strong. I haven't lost my bark, and it's never gone. It'll always be there.
Let's talk briefly about the EU. You've said you could not imagine Britain rejoining the EU in your political lifetime, and you still look pretty hale and hearty to me. You were a passionate supporter of Britain's membership of the EU. Why so pessimistic now? And if you can't see your way back to some form of kind of full membership, maybe you could start to look at something like rejoining the EU's customs union. The Mayor of London has basically flown kites for this sort of thing, saying, for heaven's sake, move us a bit closer again to the European Union. Your thoughts?
We had a bitter divorce with the European Union. It went on for many, many years. We only effectively sorted out custody of the children with the Windsor framework that Rishi Sunak was able to finally settle, despite the horrendous saber-rattling on the Northern Ireland Protocol and pulling out of the European Convention on Human Rights and a whole raft of things that were being suggested that were causing huge alarm, I have to say, in Washington, right across the political aisle. For that reason, we need to get back to structured dialogue with the European Union at the moment.
About
what?
We're
not even, well, precisely, about security, about energy, about climate, about AI. We're not in those conversations. We're not in the room under this government. We've got to get back into the room and have those discussions and on a pretty regular basis. I think that the Boris Johnson made a huge mistake when he rejected the defence and security pact with the European Union. And we see now with war in Europe how important that is. And of course, we said that we would review the trading arrangement we struck with them in 2025. We hope that we will be in power to do that review. So there's much that we can do together. There'll be a tonal shift, I think, if the Labour Party won. But we have said very clearly, we are not going back into the protracted debate about the single market and the customs union.
I have a couple of domestic politics questions before we end. Quickfire rounds, relatively quickfire for quite complicated.
You could try.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, I don't mind. I've got all the time in the world. I feel that a large hook might come and drag us off. And we do appreciate you taking a bit more thoughtful time on this podcast. So Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, has given a speech actually just on the day I'm talking to you, a couple of days ahead of release of this podcast, channeling the Margaret Thatcher legacy and basically suggesting this is an inflection point for Labour economically if it comes to power like 1979. She hasn't shied away from comparing the kind of shake-up that she feels would be necessary to get Britain back on track economically and in business as occurred under Margaret Thatcher. Now, this to many on the left of centre, indeed many of your colleagues, and I'm sure you've all given fiery speeches in the past about the terrible years of Tory torture under Margaret Thatcher. When this was suggested, was your thought, man, is that a bit weird?
No, actually, I think it's very apposite. If you look back to the end of the 1970s, Britain on its knees, sick man of Europe, we weren't even able to bury our dead and sort out our rubbish. I'm afraid we were in a mess, and it did need big economics to get us out of that mess. Now, you can take issue with Mrs. Thatcher's prescription, but she had a big manifesto for change and set about a course that lasted for over 2 decades.
Did you admire her at the time when you were a young man and a rising politician? I've known you long enough to remember
what you. What I saw under Margaret Thatcher was also considerable unemployment, which was a huge challenge, and it certainly affected the community I was growing up with in Tottenham. Having said that, in terms of big economics and where Britain finds itself today, low growth, no growth, very poor public services, education and health, huge queues now in the health service. Our local authorities cut back 50%. This is going to need a massive shake-up. And Rachel Reeves, the first woman in her role, if we win the next election, is absolutely setting up the kind of vision that
we need. So you don't really mind the Thatcher comparison? It landed okay with you?
We need vision for growth. I accept that while she comes from a different tradition, of course Margaret Thatcher was a visionary leader for the UK. No doubt about it. That's absolutely clear.
We always ask our guests before they leave us who they'd like to hear on Power Play next. We need to get more of you as listeners. Who would convince you to subscribe to us?
Well, I think Mia Mottley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, is someone that you should get on. I say that because I think that her Bridgetown initiative has really changed the weather on climate and climate finance. I know her personally very well, and I think she's going to continue to be an important actor, not just in her region, but beyond.
Right. Consider it. Producer Peter Snow's got it all written down, and I'm quite up for a trip to Barbados. David Lammy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's edition. We hope you enjoy our transatlantic conversation. Do keep listening and maybe give us a rate and review when you're in an especially sunny mood. If you'd like to get all of our episodes immediately they're published, follow PowerPlay wherever you're listening. The team behind this podcast is Peter Snowden, senior producer in London, and the executive producer in Brussels, Christina Gonzalez. I'm Anne McElvoy. Thanks for listening.